Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Singeri. If the pandemic was an amusement park ride, which it most definitely is not, it would be a roller coaster combined with the bumping cars, fused to the tilt-a-whirl. Many ups and downs, extremely bumpy, and shifting spins and angles. When the COVID vaccine was rolled out in December, it felt like we were going to see the end of this long global nightmare. And while the U.S. and most developed countries have had ample doses, many people have been hesitant to roll up their sleeves. And many third world countries have not had enough doses. So as things do, the coronavirus has persisted and morphed. We're now being hit by the Delta variant, but far be it from me to understand exactly the way and what of the Delta. Luckily, we have state epidemiologist Dr. Patsy Kelso with us this morning to explain it to us. Dr. Kelso, always a pleasure getting to speak with you. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Rick.
You're welcome. Listeners, if you've got questions about the Delta variant for Dr. Kelso, give us a call, 244-1777. Toll-free 877-291-8255, or you can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Dr. Kelso, with viruses like COVID-19, how do these variants develop?
Viruses mutate all the time. That's just what they do. They swap genetic material with other viruses, and they can change into something a bit different. And that's why we need a new flu vaccine every year, because the flu virus has little small shifts and changes that make it a bit different, and we need a new vaccine to combat it. Variants are not unexpected. We've seen many, many variants, and sometimes a variant makes viruses more easily transmitted, or cause more severe illness. Sometimes they cause less severe illness. We'll continue to see this with small changes. The Delta variant is significant because it's more infectious and it's more easily spread from person to person. And we need Vermonters and the world to be vaccinated to prevent more variants from emerging and to slow down transmission.
So if we were able to reach a certain percentage of people vaccinated, I guess we'd have to say globally, right, Doctor? Does the likelihood of spread and the development of new variants end or slow down, or what happens?
Well, we can be highly protected in Vermont and in the United States if people are vaccinated. The fact is that while we're seeing an upsurge in cases, and while we are seeing some cases in fully vaccinated people, the majority of cases are among people who are not fully vaccinated. So if we get vaccinated here in Vermont and in the U.S., we'll slow down transmission enough that we can really keep this in check. If the majority of the world is not yet vaccinated, there might still be the surges of Delta in other parts of the world or new variants that emerge. But if we're vaccinated, we'll be largely protected, especially against severe outcomes like hospitalization and death.
How much more contagious is the Delta variant than the original version and the previous variants?
The original version resulted in every case infecting probably 2 to 3 additional cases without mitigation measures in place. And the Delta variant is something like 5 or 6 new infections for every case, again, with no mitigation measures in place. So, vaccination is the most effective, most important strategy for preventing spread, but other things like wearing masks and getting tested to know whether you're a case, if you're asymptomatic, staying away from other people, all these things are tools in the toolbox, but vaccination is the most important one.
Dr. Kelso, with the spread of the variant, the Delta variant here in Vermont, how is that affecting UVM, other hospitals in Vermont right now?
Hospitals are holding steady. you know, we're closely looking at the data every day. And while we are seeing some people in the hospital in Vermont with COVID infections, those numbers are not jumping up. So hospitals are able to manage the COVID hospitalizations currently, and we're not seeing anything that suggests that that's going to change significantly in the wrong direction in the coming weeks. So, you know, there's been a lot of unmet need for care during the course of the pandemic. So people are certainly in the hospital with other illnesses and conditions and healthcare needs. But the COVID hospitalizations are holding steady and manageable at this time.
All right. That's good to hear. Our numbers are 244-1777. You can call toll free 877-291-TALK. That's 877-291-8255. Let's go to the phones. We've got Fred joining us from Newbury. Good morning, Fred.
Good morning. To mask or not to mask, that is the question. Mm-hmm. I'm very confused. I've had two of the inoculations.
Mm-hmm.
And I assume that I'm protected, but, you know, do I wear a mask or don't I wear a mask? And the blue mask that we get at Walmart or wherever we go,
mm-hmm.
do they really work? I don't know.
Fred, those are great questions. Yeah, and I think this is exactly what's on everyone's mind. And, I mean, I think we all want to unmask, no doubt, after being masked for so long. But here's this variant. It seems, Dr. Kelso, that it's even spreading with some who have been vaccinated, the breakthrough. So Fred asks great questions. Should I be masking again, social distancing? Should I are the blue masks that are so prevalent, are they effective? What are your answers to those questions?
Masking is an individual choice, and Vermonters should think about their own circumstances. If they are fully vaccinated, but they have people in their household who are unable to be vaccinated, for example, children under the age of 12, or if they have someone who has a condition that makes them more vulnerable, it compromises their immune system, those people, even though they're fully vaccinated, might choose to wear a mask just to be extra careful and protect those vulnerable people in their household. If you're fully vaccinated and you aren't around vulnerable people, it's perfectly fine not to wear a mask. So I think it's an individual calculus that people have to think about, what would it mean for them and the people around them. And, you know, masking is not a bad idea, but it's not something that we feel at this time needs to be imposed on a majority of Vermonters. It's certainly something that individuals can choose to do. And as far as which masks, anything over your nose and mouth that prevents droplets when you talk or laugh or cough from getting out is going to be helpful, whether it's a cloth face covering or those blue masks or a KN95 respirator. Anything is better than nothing if you choose to wear a mask.
All right. Thanks for the questions, Fred. They're on everyone's minds, and it's good to get that answered. Dr. Kelso, what is it that makes this Delta variant more contagious than the others?
Oh, that's a tricky question. Something about a little mutation in the virus itself that probably having to do with the spike protein on the surface of the virus and how it attaches to cells and mm-hmm. how it replicates in our noses. I'm not entirely sure, but these types of changes are what can make a virus replicate faster or more readily and then have more of it produced so that when we do talk or laugh, more of it gets expelled, even if we're asymptomatic.
And are the symptoms any different, any more severe than the other forms of COVID that we're seeing with the Delta variant?
I think the data is mixed on that. We are certainly seeing across the United States more people in the hospital than we were several months ago, but it's not clear from the data that that's because the Delta variant causes more severe illness. What I think is just that we're seeing more cases overall, and therefore, if, you know, 0.5% of people who get COVID need to be in the hospital, we're going to see more people in the hospital if we have more cases. So the data is still not clear that Delta causes more severe illness.
Yeah. Dr. Kelso, how effective are the COVID vaccines against the Delta variant?
I'm glad you asked because I wanted to make sure I got this point in. Mm-hmm. The COVID vaccines that we have in the United States are highly effective against the Delta variant. But what we're learning is that with the mRNA vaccines that require two doses, that's the Moderna and Pfizer vaccines, having just one dose of the vaccine is not as effective as having two doses. So if you're a Vermonter who is only partially vaccinated, meaning you only have one dose of either Moderna or Pfizer, please go ahead and get your second dose because you'll be much better protected against the Delta variant.
Even if there's been a gap of several months, you got the first dose back in, let's say, March, and still haven't gotten the second dose, it's still effective to get that second dose now?
Yeah, there's not really clear data on that. We know that you can go several months. You can get your second dose several months late and have it still be very effective. And there's no data suggesting that if you wait too long, it won't be beneficial. So even if it's been a long time, many months, go ahead and get your second dose. You'll be better protected.
And then let's move right on to the third dose, a booster that we've been hearing about. Is that on the way? Is that something that at least older, more vulnerable Vermonters will be hearing about or considering in the next weeks or months?
We're hearing that it's coming. We don't have a full recommendation yet from the CDC Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices for a booster dose for fully vaccinated people, but we're hearing that it's coming sometime probably this fall. And what we'll likely do is we're hearing the recommendation will be once it's been 8 months or more since your full series that you should get a booster dose. And so if that comes to fruition, we would likely see a similar process to what Vermont did a long time ago with offering the booster dose to healthcare providers and long-term care facility staff and residents, and then older Vermonters going, you know, down through the age groups because the people who got it earliest should get the booster earliest.
All right. And you mentioned people who haven't gotten the second dose. How do they arrange now to get that second dose?
Our health department website has information about how to find a vaccine. Our website is healthvermont.gov, and there are lots of options. There are community clinics, pharmacies. Many of the sites offer walk-ins. Some require appointments. All the information is available on our website. So if you just haven't had a chance to get your second dose, go to healthvermont.gov and, you know, get that second dose on board.
All right. Dr. Kelso, again, another question about a mask. This is from Mary, who emails about the N92 mask. Says, a friend wants to mail me one. How effective are these? I can't find much about them.
Yeah, I don't know much about N92 masks, but what I can say is the N95 masks are typically used in healthcare settings. They are well fitted to the face. There's different brands and sizes of them, and what typically happens in a healthcare setting is healthcare providers are fitted to see which mask and which size best fits their particular face. To provide protection against things like tuberculosis or viruses. N95 masks are not needed for the general public. It's okay to use them, but any mask or covering over your nose and mouth that prevents droplets from escaping your nose and mouth is going to be effective. So I wouldn't worry too much about finding a particular kind. There are KN95s that are widely available, and there are those blue masks and cloth face coverings. All of those are good options.
Boy, this feels like the conversations we were having last March and April, doesn't it, Dr. Kelso?
It sure does.
All right. Now, Vermont is the gold standard in the country. You know, we're at 85% vaccinated. Is that enough? Is the health department saying we're there, or are you still trying to get Vermonters vaccinated?
We're still trying to get Vermonters vaccinated, definitely. We have over 85% of eligible Vermonters who have gotten at least one dose. And when we look at the whole population, 75% of Vermonters have at least one dose. We still have eligible Vermonters who are not vaccinated. And, of course, we still have the children younger than age 12 who are not yet eligible. We need as many Vermonters as possible to get vaccinated, because when we look at our case rates and what's been happening with the Delta surge across the country, we are faring much better than states with lower vaccination rates. And vaccination clearly is the best thing we have to prevent COVID transmission.
Dr. Kelso, I read that a recent study from the United Kingdom showed that children and adults under 50 are 2.5 times more likely to become infected with Delta. The one thing I think parents are probably wondering is this a possible effect that could mean we're going to have in-person classes curtailed again this year? And I know you're not with the Agency of Education, and this isn't a question about, you know, closing schools, but, you know, are we in a position where we can see children really being contracting the COVID-19?
Well, we've been seeing cases among children as well as adults throughout the summer. And, you know, children younger than 12 are not yet able to be vaccinated. We think it's coming soon, and we'll be ready to sort of roll out those clinics when we have the go-ahead. There are a number of people 12 and older in Vermont who are eligible to be vaccinated but haven't gotten vaccinated yet. Ultimately, it's most important for kids to be in school. And while we are going to see cases in the school age population, I don't think we'll get to the point where we need to close down school. We will have cases, and we will have close contacts who need to be in quarantine, but the virus is at a manageable point in Vermont, and the more young people we get vaccinated, the less disruptions there will be.
Is it likely that you and I could be having this same discussion in the months ahead about another new COVID variant?
It's certainly possible. But again, at the high vaccination rates, even if there are variants that that the vaccine is not as effective against, with so many of Vermont protected against transmission, I don't think we'll get to a bad place again. If we can just keep up the vaccination pace, we're adding people every day. And, you know, we'll have to see. Viruses do what they do, and they do change, and they do different things. But we'll keep vaccinating people, and we'll deal with new variants if they come.
Do you have a message for Vermonters before I let you go?
Yeah, keep ahead of what's going on with COVID in Vermont. It's going to be a bit bumpy as we get into the fall, and you know we're going to get kids back in school, and we're going to have some cases continuing, and we'll have cases in schools. We'll manage them, and we can get through this. I think Vermont's in the best place in the country when it comes to vaccination and our case rates. And while we are seeing a bit of a surge, we're hopeful that given what we've seen with Delta surges in other states, and in other countries, we think this trend will start a downturn in the near future.
And we've gotten through a year and a half by doing the right thing here in Vermont. And so however long it takes, we just have to stay the course at this point. Dr. Patsy Kelso is Vermont State Epidemiologist. Dr. Kelso, thank you so much for your time this morning.
Thank you.
All right, we're going to take a break, and then we're going to open up the phones. We'll spend some time talking about Irene and Henri. And thanks to Henri, the Red Sox-Rangers game yesterday was washed out, so they'll get up to that today. The WDEV coverage begins at 12:10. First pitch is 1:10. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. All right, we've got open phones now till 10 o'clock, and our numbers are 244-1777, 877-291-8255. It's been almost exactly 10 years since Tropical Storm Irene came barreling into Vermont and New England and left behind that trail of destruction. And, within about a week of that anniversary, here comes Henri slamming into New England, and expect it to at least give some rain to the southern part of Vermont, but definitely causing some havoc where it's hit so far. Hopefully what we see here, not as strong and not as destructive as Irene. But if you'd like to share, first of all, if you've seen anything of Henri in your area, you can call in 244-1777. 877-291-8255. But I'd like to flip back to a decade ago, and you can tell us what you experienced during Irene. I'm sure many in the area here in Waterbury alone, but throughout the state, saw quite a bit of devastation. And our numbers are 244-1777, 877-291-8255. Phones open till 10. And, of course, with open phones, you can bring up any subject you'd like. But it seems like the weather and hurricanes or tropical storms or whatever they get downgraded to when they finally hit Vermont, hopefully we can talk about. I will tell you that 10 years ago on the Saturday – before Irene hit, because you remember it was a Sunday when Irene hit here in Vermont, I was at Fenway, and they were playing a game against the Oakland A's, and the Sunday game, they knew in advance enough. Now, this year with Henri, the game's been flipped again with the Rangers to Monday, but what the Sox had done was to play a day-night doubleheader on that Saturday, so this was the first time that I got to be up with the K-men. These are the guys who hang the K's for the starting pitcher. Yeah. And they do it for one particular – whoever the ace is at the time. So it was my first opportunity, 2011, to be hanging K's up there with the K-men. And, no, it was not Dice K at the time. It was a great day, but very rainy, and I think there was already a delay early in the first game. So I think we made it to about the fifth inning and decided that that was about it for the day, as most fans did. This was the first game of a day-night doubleheader. I got back to my car out at Alewife at the T-stop there and could listen to the game. All the way back up to Vermont, the first game, because it took so long. Then they took a break and started the second game late. It had to be, 7:30, 8:30 at night, something like that. And it was rainy. By the second inning, there were so few fans in Fenway I was watching it then on NESN when I got home, and the Red Sox announced that anyone who could make it to the stadium could get in free. There were, like I said, 2,000 or 3,000 fans in Fenway for that second game. And if you were in the Boston area, I mean, if you want to sit out in the rain or under, you could sit under, you know, the covered there, you could have got into Fenway for free and seen most of the game too. And they finished quite late against the Oakland A's, but that was, Boston preparing, you know, the Red Sox getting the games out of the way because, we knew that Irene was going to hit sometime on Sunday. And that's exactly what happened here in Vermont. Tropical Storm Irene. I do remember Saturday night into Sunday morning, my electricity went out and my fire alarm, I guess the battery ran out. And so I didn't have another, what are they, 10-volt, 8-volt batteries? Anyway, those batteries. 9-volt. It's a 9-volt. Yeah, again, above and below, there it is. It's a 9-volt battery. I didn't have another 9-volt, and so the thing kept beeping all night. So already this was a bit of a mess, and then I had beeping all night long, and I stuck my iPod, you know, in my ears and just played music and to drown out the beeping so I could get to sleep. And I probably got about 4 or 5 hours sleep that day. All right, that was a wild time. I know Waterbury was hit. It was just devastated. But what happened in your area? Houses were moved. Remember in Brandon, there was a business, like a pizza place, that got lifted and kind of moved across the street. There was a family in Rochester whose home was moved up and off its base. And boy, you would drive through southern parts of Vermont even years afterwards and you could still see how the rivers and streams had been affected and shifted. And there were, on that Sunday, initially, I think 13 Vermont towns. We'll hear tonight, as a matter of fact, got a great special that David Goodman will be hosting here on WDEV. I think that's at 7 o'clock. But initially, I think there were 13 Vermont towns that were cut off, that could not get in or out. And the state, I mean, had to just waive rules for transportation, for VTrans, for the Department of Transportation to shift roads to get people in and out of these towns that were cut off initially. Boy, it was quite a time. All right, if you want to talk about it and share a memory, 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. Boy, I remember there was a school up in the Chittenden area. When I say up, because it's up there in the mountain, down in Rutland County, and the kids couldn't get to their the school bus couldn't get them to the school because it was cut off, roads were washed out, and so the kids the parents would be at one end of a path through the woods, and the kids would walk through the woods about a mile to parents meeting them on the other side. And then getting them to the school. Wow. Wild times, wasn't it? And, but scary. And, the destruction was, serious and, All right. Let's go to the phones and we've got Joe joining us. Hi, Joe. Go right ahead.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. How you doing?
Good. Hope you can hear me. All right. I was just thinking about that decade ago.
Where were you at the time?
I was coming in from, I was going to work coming in from Waitsfield, and I was working down by the wayside for the transportation department. And I remember battling over from Waitsfield, you know, having to go through Waterbury because 100B was closed to get through Moortown. And then you had to battle through Waterbury because Waterbury was a lake.
Yes, it was.
And then you had to, once you got down by the hilltop in there to get down to the traffic shop in Berlin, that was a mess. That was a lake down there across from the wayside.
Wow.
And then we ended up spending the next 2 months going around and setting up all these detour packages for DTrans, the transportation right. department, so that everybody could get around.
Yeah. Wow. What were you driving? That you seem to have made through some really high-standing water. What were you driving at the time, Joe?
A four-door Subaru coupe.
There you go. Great ad for a Subaru. It gets you through. Oh, my gosh. But working for the DOT at the time must have been the most incredible job to have, to see, the devastation. And then just the work you guys did was incredible very quickly to get people through.
We were everywhere from Rochester to Jamaica, yep. to, up a little further. And it was crazy. They were making roads everywhere just to get people around. And you wouldn't believe the detours people were taking.
Man. Yeah. I remember going through Jamaica a few years afterwards, and you could still see, how the water had, moved so much down there, even though, it was a couple of years later, the effects of Irene were still evident in the town of Jamaica.
Yeah. You can still see it today, I guess, if you go in the right spot.
Yeah. Wow. Well, kudos.
It was a pretty interesting day.
Yeah. Well, thank you for the work you did and fighting through from Waitsfield to Berlin. That really took quite a lot of effort on your part, and then to help the state as you did. So thanks so much for the call, and thanks for what you did, Joe.
Yeah, see ya.
All right, take care. And I'd love to hear about, how things went with you. It's so funny. We're so far away from Hurricane Alley, and yet we've had to contend with Irene, indeed, and possibly Henri. Did we get any of Sandy? I think we got just remnants of that. Phones are open, though, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. What do you remember about Irene? And it struck in just one day. It was that Sunday. But, boy, the devastation lasted for months afterwards. People really struggled for a long time after Irene came through. Now, I moved here from Miami, Florida, and I used to joke that there were no natural disasters wherever I am. One time when I was living in Ohio, out in Dayton, I left for the weekend and came back to learn that there were minor tremors. There was a quote unquote earthquake in Dayton, Ohio, but I was gone. So that's why it happened while I was away. In Miami, whenever there were hurricanes headed for Miami, they would seem to veer off and hit the Atlantic coast up the line a bit, or the Gulf Coast, but never hit Miami. Then they had several, after I left there, several devastating ones. But I finally, this was even before Irene, I was finally caught by one. So I'm living in Miami. I had a client just north of New Orleans, about an hour north of New Orleans. So you flew in and out of New Orleans. And we were supposed to have a Wednesday meeting, and we were supposed to fly out, and a hurricane heads into the Gulf of Mexico. And so we scrapped the meeting, moved it to the following Wednesday, and it did indeed hit New Orleans. That one, I think by the time it hit, might have been a tropical storm. But we moved the meeting back to the following Wednesday, and all of a sudden, Tuesday, here's another hurricane in the Gulf, and it doesn't know, you don't know if it's going to hit from Biloxi, Mississippi to Houston, Texas, once it gets in there. But, of course, New Orleans was a possibility. But we flew out to New Orleans, went up to the client about an hour north of New Orleans on this Wednesday, and by middle of the afternoon, it looked like the hurricane was definitely coming into New Orleans. And I told my boss, I really think we should leave. I think we should get out of here tonight and or this afternoon, you know, have our meeting and then leave. Well, they were going to have dinner for us, and he thought it would be rude for us to take off. So we stuck around, and we drove down to New Orleans that night to fly out first thing in the morning. Well, by the time it got to about 4:30, 5 o'clock, he was banging on my hotel door saying, "We got to get out of here. The hurricane's coming." Yeah, and all the flights out of New Orleans had been canceled. And so I rerouted us from Birmingham, Alabama, our flight, to Miami, and had to drive across Lake Pontchartrain on the causeway there through the outer bands of that hurricane. And I believe that was 02. I think those were Hannah and Isidore. Isidore was a Cat 3 hurricane by the time it hit New Orleans, and I was driving through the outer bands of it. So just escaped that one. All right, we're at 244-1777, 877-291-8255. Love to hear your stories about Irene, and we're going to go to Facetown and talk to Cindy. Hi, Cindy, what's going on?
Hi, yes. I have a story. Well, some, my parents were coming to visit me on a surprise, and they drove, and they were pretty old, you know, at the time. And my father's no longer alive, but my father, you know, always wondered why I lived in Vermont. Mm-hmm. And
where were they driving from, Cindy?
Wisconsin.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and they were coming through the Granville Gulf there, and the road was completely washed out. And my father was, I can't remember how they got around or how they wound up, got here, but he just thought that was just like unbelievable.
And was this the day of Irene, or was this afterwards?
I think it was just happening. I can't quite remember exactly, but wow. I think it was just happening. And they were driving, and my father thought he'd take the scenic route, you mm-hmm. know, and come up.
Sure.
And yeah.
It makes sense.
Yeah. No, not after that. But he was, you know, they went around somehow. They got around. But, yeah.
Yeah, coming up through the middle of Vermont on that day was the worst possible choice, where, you know, had you come up, say, 87 through New York and cut over, you would have been much safer that way. Cindy.
Well, he always liked to travel, you know, so he would always, you know, take these scenic routes or whatever. And
Is that Route 100 coming up? That's gorgeous. That's so beautiful.
That's
one of the best drives you can possibly do, Cindy.
I know. He had a great idea, but it didn't really work out that great. But they wound up, they finally did get to my house. So.
Oh, that's good to hear. Safely,
And they were like, you know, they're pretty old, in their 80s.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow. But they persevered, and they got to see it, and that's a lovely story. But, yeah, scary. Thanks so much for that, Cindy. All right. And the one other thing we should remember was, and I had a guest on earlier this year to talk about it, was the flooding that we saw that spring. And that was Lake Champlain was at record high levels. Boy, poor Isle of Mott was underwater. And there was so much devastation in the spring, and FEMA was already here taking care of all that. There was a lot of, I think, winter snow melt and a lot of rain, and the lake was at record highs. I'm sure the Lamoille was probably high and flooding its banks. And so I guess the only positive was FEMA was already here in place, still in place, when Irene happened. All right, we're going to turn off phones, pop out for news. Then we're going to be back to talk with the folks in Elmore about the scholarship fund they've started in the memory of Warren Miller and plans they have for the Elmore store. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. You know, someone has a special part in a community when they receive the unofficial title of mayor by all the townspeople. That was Warren Miller in Elmore. Alas, a little over a year ago, Warren Miller passed away. But his passing has spurred the people of Elmore to take very positive actions. One was to establish a memorial scholarship fund in Miller's name. We're joined now by a couple of the individuals involved in that effort. Todd Baxter is the Warren Miller Memorial Scholarship Fund Board Chair. Todd, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And joining us also from the board is Joe Ciccolo. And Joe, it's great to have you here as well.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Now, listeners, to ask Todd and Joe about the scholarship fund, and you can give us a call, or to share your memories of Warren Miller, you can give us a call at 244-1777. 877-291-8255. You can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Todd, tell us who Warren Miller was.
Wow. How much time do we have? Where do I start? First and foremost, Warren Miller was a great Vermonter. He was born and raised in Lamoille County, born at Copley Hospital. And from there, he attended People's Academy. He met his wife, Kathy, there. And then they started their life together and they were in a store in Johnson, Vermont, and then they wound up in Elmore in 1983. I didn't get to know Warren until about 2001 when I moved here. Mm-hmm. And I met him within the first 3 months of moving here. And ever since then, I've just been a friend of his. He's just a really great guy. And there's so much to say about him. Yeah. But the biggest thing is friend, great person, always there to help, very community oriented. And there's just, and he loved to wear shorts too, by the way.
every day of the year.
Every day.
Every day of the year. Well, Joe, he obviously touched the people of Elmore and the surrounding area. What was it about Warren that affected people so much that they want to make sure that he's remembered now?
Well, a genuine person. You knew where Warren stood, no doubt about it. Good, bad, or indifferent. And you would move on as friends, you know, whether you agreed or disagreed. But that's how he was, you know. This is what he does, and this is what you do. And it was a great relationship. I met him in 87. We had bought a camp at the lake, and the neighbor said, oh, there's this young couple that have bought the store, and you're just going to love them. So you go to the Elmore store. There they are, Kathy and Warren Miller, and that's where you always check in. As Todd said, the unofficial mayor, you want to know about purchasing cars, real estate, livestock, food, way to go and parts of the county or the state. Warren was there. He's like, he was the Siri of Elmore before Siri even existed.
I was going to say he's the Mr. Haney, like in Green Acres of Elmore, but
a good, we hit it off. I'm from the Boston area, and I came into the store and came into his life. He came into my life, and he made trips down to Boston with his family, stayed at our home, and we stayed at his home off season because the camp wasn't winterized. And he just was, you know, a warm, fuzzy guy.
I'd love to hear that. Todd, where did the idea of the scholarship fund come from?
Well, the idea was a process, and a little bit about that. So Warren loved the fireworks, and the fireworks are every Labor Day. And I've been staying on Lake Elmore directly across from the store. So one evening with the lights, the fireworks, I had some red lights out. They were road flares along the lake. And Warren, the next day, is like, what were those red lights? They were awesome. And I'm like, well, they're flares. I said, we should get everybody in town to do that, you know, around the lake. And we'll have like this ring of fire and it looks really great and it would be really cool. And he's like, yeah, let's do that. Well, then COVID comes and then Warren passes away. So we're in that process. And I went to Kathy and I asked her, I said, Kathy, do you mind if I still kind of work on that dream of lighting up the lake in a ring of fire? And she's like, absolutely, that'd be great. And I got thinking about that, and I'm like, you know, somebody's going to burn something down. We can't have road flares. We can't have all this stuff. So I still want to do this, but I got to think about it more. But I'm like, you know, I haven't heard anybody talk about a scholarship. So I went to Kathy, and I said, Kathy, can I start a scholarship in Warren's name and in his honor? Because he was just such a great member of our community, and just he was everything. Yeah. You know, I mean, he was the mayor. And she said, that would be wonderful. And I asked friends of Warren's and other members in the community if they would join me in that effort. And we did, and here we are.
Anything happening with the Ring of Fire?
Yes. As a matter of fact, we are. It was the original thing to call it Warren's Ring. And I wanted to do that through the COVID idea was that we would do it and be like, in solidarity together, and we can show that, you know, community can be great together and we're still here for each other. Mm-hmm. Look to your right, look to your left, the symbolism of that light. I mean, that's why the red got chosen too, by the way. It's just simply, it was a road flare. And we are going to be doing that on September 4th, the night of the fireworks, a lot going on in Elmore, which we'll get to. Mm-hmm. But yeah, we've been selling lights and it doesn't have to be our light. Just turn on a red light that night, September 4th. And show your commitment to each other.
Love that. Hey, Joe, give us some details on who's eligible, how much the recipient will get this scholarship fund. Or do you want to take it, Todd? Who knows this better?
Well, first of all, it's important that the kids that apply for it understand the meaning of community.
Yep.
And all you have to do is turn to Warren's life and what he did, you know, as an individual, to help so many people in the community and how we love the community. And that's how we ended up with the criteria for it. But some of the major points I think Todd can hit.
All right, good. That.
Yeah, I mean, specifically, they have to, written in our scholarship is an understanding of what it means to be community oriented. How they have demonstrated their commitment, service to the community thus far, and how they plan to do so in the future. And this has to be done in an essay. Mm-hmm. And they have to tell us that they're moving on to secondary education. It could be tech school, anything. And it also, it's anybody in Elmore that's graduating senior, not just from PA, but they could be private school or mm-hmm. homeschooled.
Sure.
So any senior that would be graduating.
And there's a very specific amount they'll receive.
There is. There is. The minimal amount that we have is Warren died on August 5th of 2020, and not many of us like to be in a box that are on this board, so we do things a little differently. But we wanted to memorialize that as well, so we made it $805.20.
It's a beautiful thing. It really just such rich sentiment. So now, how much has been raised for the scholarship fund?
So thus far, we have approximately $6,000, mm-hmm. and this is without the match. Okay,
right. Tell people about that match.
We have a match grant given by James Casey, who was a longtime friend of Warren Miller's. He has agreed to match up to $25,000. So right now, per se, we have right around $12,000.
Right.
So let's get out there and donate. And the point of all of this is to make this last and go into perpetuity. We want to be able to fund it, and it'll just fund itself. And that's why we're putting on these big pushes, and we want it to be here for our community.
Yeah. Now, I think you've already chosen your first recipient of the Warren Miller Memorial Scholarship. Joe, can you tell us about the recipient?
Well, it's Annie Boudreaux, who's a local Elmore girl, of course. Actually lives across the road from where I live at the lakes up on Route 12. Mm. Great family. And as you read her application, you felt not only her appreciation of sense of community, but you really got a picture of how she's involved herself in her community, whether it's been her church community, her neighborhood, doing things for others. And in her writing, she highlighted some of the other citizens in Elmore and what they do. So she gets it quite well, I'd say. I mean, it was a pretty easy decision of all the applicants. I think we all came back with the same, you know, hierarchy of first, second, and third, and so forth. So she was the first recipient.
And do we know where she's going to school, what she's going to study?
She is going to UVM, and I don't want to mess up on what she's going to study. So.
All right. We'll say right now she's undecided, but she probably knows what route she's taking. Todd, as you've gotten this scholarship fund up and running, I'm sure that you've heard from many people who knew Warren. What are the things you've heard from them?
One of the things that is the common thread that I keep hearing is, like, what a great honor and tribute to a good man, a great man, you know, and that's what they talk about. Like, this is well, you know, it's like, well done. This is exactly what he would have wanted. This is exactly what we need. You know, and then the stories come.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I literally sat out in front of the store with our sign, with my kids, and we're selling the lights, and everybody's got a story. And you know, even you, Joe. Maybe we could talk about the first time we met, like parking.
Well, you know, Warren always impressed upon me. He said, "Joe, this is a very small community, and neighbors really have to get along with one another." And that doesn't mean that your neighbor gets along with you. That means that both neighbors get along with one another. And that has resonated with me forever. And the thing about Warren and Kathy, you know, they do a lot of things behind the scenes that you never really hear about, yeah. But the results of which, you know, benefit many people. And I think that's the part that's important. They didn't do it for show. They did it to help people in their community. And they would go out of their way. I mean, they would go and pick somebody up if they had a flat tire and help them to get it fixed. I mean, over the years, the things that they've done, you know, a real sense of community.
Yeah. And now we're joined by Mark Isselhardt. He's vice president of the Elmore Community Trust. Mark, welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint in a non-Maple Minute discussion. Great to have you.
Hey, Rick. Thanks for having me. And hi, Todd and Joe.
Morning. Hey, Mark.
Mark, what is the Elmore Community Trust?
Yeah, so the Elmore Community Trust, it's an official 501c3 nonprofit that was founded in 2019. And we have a pretty clear goal, which is caring for the places that make Elmore special. And that can mean lots of different things, but we're targeting businesses, organizations, and residents, you know, bringing them to our community and supporting them to make a positive, vibrant rural community.
And what are you trying to do for the Elmore store?
Right. So our first project with the trust is the Elmore Store Project. And the idea is to follow a model that was championed by Paul Bruhn, who was the longtime executive director of the Preservation Trust of Vermont. And the model goes like this. You have a nonprofit purchase, in this case, the property, the real estate of the store. And then the nonprofit leases that structure to an operator. So we're selecting an operator who will run the store. And then the future rent generated from that operator, that successful business, will then be used for future projects. And if this model has been successful around the state, Guilford, East Callis, and most recently in Albany have followed this model. And the important thing is that, you know, it's not the trust running the store. We're kind of custodians for the building, making sure that all the big capital investments in the structure aren't a burden to the operator, but they can be as successful as possible, helping the community with the community's needs. And Warren and Kathy ran the store for 37 years, and it's a lot like farming in a way. I'm sure Warren would agree. You know, you get maybe one day off a year, and even then, if someone needs something, you know they're going to be there for you. So we're trying to preserve that community resource as well.
Wow, the spirits of Paul Bruhn and Warren Miller together. It's got to be a lot of great energy to get this done. You've got several events, Mark, scheduled for Labor Day weekend. Tell us about what's going on. First of all, on Saturday, the celebration on Saturday.
Sure. I mean, Warren was a huge fan of the fireworks and would end the night with fireworks at dusk. But at 9 a.m., folks who are looking for some excitement and energy and exercise are participating in a 5K run or walk that starts at the firehouse and runs along the camp road past Joe's house and then back again. And that's a good run and community event. This is the second time they've done it. They had to take a break because of COVID. And then right after that, there's going to be a 31-mile gravel bike ride that's going to cover some pretty exciting terrain. And Todd knows that terrain pretty well. And so we're going to be doing that big loop, 31-mile loop. And then you come back, and there'll be the block party, which is a favorite of folks in Elmore and in the surrounding community. And that includes music. That all kicks off at 3 p.m. There'll be some great barbecue, and there'll be a couple of different bands playing. A band called the High Breaks are playing at 3, and the Eames Brothers are playing at 6. And then you get it towards dusk, and you got fireworks, and then the lighting of the lights, the red lights around the lake in Warren's honor.
Mm. Boy, I'm choking up just thinking about it. That's kind of beautiful. Todd, how do you see the Elmore Community Trust and the scholarship working together to benefit this community?
Hey, this is all things Elmore. I mean, that's what it's about. That's what Warren would have wanted it about. That's what we want it to be. And that's how we're going to – they're one and the same. The trust is taking over the store that was Warren's home. That's the heart of the community. There's a lot more great things to come. They're one and the same.
Yeah.
You know, so that's how they're going to work together. That's why they're here.
Mark, did you want to share a memory of Warren Miller?
Yeah, you know, one of the things about I'll tie it to the trust real quick, but is, you know, the trust is made up of 10 people. 9 out of those folks are from Elmore, and we've got business owners, farmers, sugar makers, artists, engineers. But we also have several graduates of the Elmore School, and which is, folks might know, is the last one-room schoolhouse in Vermont. And both my kids were able to attend. And I have to say, you know, just picking up or dropping off kids at the school and walking over and chatting with Warren and seeing his presence, and he loved the school so much. And, you know, he looked after it. And, you know, I think having that vision for what the school is and how important it is to the downtown and Elmore. And I mean, that's more than anything. I think it's just, we want to continue that spirit of community and looking over not just the store, but the community, broader community of Elmore. And I think that's my best memory of Warren right there.
Mm. Joe, for those who don't know Elmore very well, is this indicative of what the town and its community members are all about?
Absolutely. You know, there are a few entities in the community. There's the Elmore Church, there's the schoolhouse, and then there's the Lake Association. And it doesn't matter which group you come from. Everybody bands together. You know, if there's a church supper, everybody in the community's there. The Halloween party for the kids, people come not only with children but residents. I've gone there myself to help in the past. So that's what the community is. We cross over. It's not separate. It's everybody together. When we have the chicken barbecue, 300 people come through for lunch, right through Elmore. It's the most amazing thing to see.
Mm.
So the sense of community is very welcoming, very supportive. You know, come on, let's do this together. And that's kind of how we work in the community.
What would Warren think if he could see what you're all doing right now?
Well, he had a great smile and a good laugh. And again, as I said earlier, he's a big fuzzy guy. These would mean a lot to him because he's the one. He's the impetus for all of us to get rolling on these things. If there was never a Warren Miller, you know, it wouldn't have touched us the way it has. And, yeah. You know, for folks to come up with these ideas and scholarships and community projects, he was a big driving force.
Todd, you want to tell a story about what Warren meant to you?
Just to add to that, he'd say, how can I help?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Absolutely.
How can I help? Wow. What do you need? Warren, as a friend, I went through cancer just over a year ago, and Warren took care of my home while I was away at Dana-Farber for 3 months. And he didn't ask for anything. It was just done. He said, what do you need? And I said, well, my kids and somebody's going to have to get up the driveway, which I have a heck of a driveway. And he's like, well, you know I own a plow, so I'll take care of that. So, And he's done that for many members of the community. He would drive to Boston often with another member of our community that maybe people know or maybe they don't know, but it's a very special thing. He meant a lot to me, and that's what I can say about that.
Nobody filling in as mayor right now, or what's the community doing? You just got to do this together, I guess, huh?
It
takes the whole community to fill in for Warren Miller?
There's a little piece of Warren in all of us. Mm. No one person can do it, but every one of us has a little piece of him. And together, that's how we become strong. Warren strong.
Wow. Mark Isselhard, how about future plans, future ideas that the Elmore Community Trust has?
Sure. Well, probably the best thing for folks, if they're interested, is to check out our website. It's elmorecommunitytrust.org. You can read more of the details. You know, there isn't, it may not come as a shock to people, but there isn't a whole lot of infrastructure in the downtown area in Elmore, but there are a few, and you know, we've got some eyes on it. The store project is big, though. We're well into fundraising at this point, but there's a lot more to do. There's going to be some significant foundation work and some septic and all that stuff that can't really see. So we're really focused on this one project, doing it right, making sure that we're not stretched too thin. So, you know, everyone's got ideas for the future, but I think, we're really focused on this one project and making sure that it's, enduring and successful, especially for the operator. We want to put them on the best footing possible and honor what Kathy and Warren have built over the past 37 years and make sure that it continues to be a hub. You know, it's not just a store, though. It's post office has a branch there. There's a little Union Bank ATM. We've got a really successful pizza business in there. And it's a community hub. And the whole idea is to preserve that hub. We're not talking about it being a boutique or something. It's still a place you can get some eggs and maybe a hot dog and, you know, a bag of chips or, if you forget, you know, the half and half for coffee, you know, you can get that. And, that those essentials are a big part of why the store is important to the community. So I urge people, if they're interested in learning more, if they want to donate, check out that website, elmorecommunitytrust.org.
And Todd, how do people give to the scholarship fund?
There's some links on there. They can contact us on Facebook, the Warren Miller Memorial Scholarship, but also through the trust. There should be some links on there, or just down at the store as well.
All right. Mark Isselhard, Vice President of the Elmore Community Trust, Todd Baxter, and Joe Ciccolo, members of the board of the Warren Miller Memorial Scholarship Fund. I want to thank you all for sharing your memories of the mayor of Elmore and the work you're now doing to keep his memory alive. And the website again, elmorecommunitytrust.org. News is next, then we'll be back. Take a trip across the border for some football, Canadian style. And coming up today at 11, we've got Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. You might be surprised, but the closest major professional football franchise to most of Vermont is just to the north of us. The rules are a little different than what you might be used to, but the game is just as hard-hitting, and it moves at a much quicker pace. We'll explain. The team is the Montreal Alouettes, who play their games at McGill University's Percival Molson Stadium. After taking the 2020 season off because of the pandemic, the Owls and the Canadian Football League are back. Their season started with a couple of road games, but they return to Montreal this Friday night for the first home game of the season. Here to talk Alouettes and CFL football is the team's general manager, Danny Machocha. Danny, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's great to have you. Listeners, to ask Danny a question or if you want to share your interest in the Owls, you can give us a call, 244-1777 or 877-291-8255, or you can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Now, Danny, I don't want you to go too far into this, but what are some of the key differences between Canadian and American football?
I would say the dimensions of the field. The CFL field is longer. There's a 55-yard line, so it's 110 yards from goal line to goal line, and it's a 20-yard end zone. It's 65 yards wide. It's played with 12 men on the field, three-down football, obviously, and it's unlimited motion. So all the receivers, anybody that's eligible, the receivers and running backs are able to motion, along the line of scrimmage, get a waggle with a running start into the line of scrimmage. So I would say those are probably the key factors that are different than the game that's played south of the border.
Absolutely. Wide open because of that big field, because of the three downs. So you'll see a lot more action, a lot more passing. What's the reaction, Danny, that you get from American fans when they finally get to see a Canadian football game for the first time?
The reaction I normally get from other coaches that have come up here or even fans that I've met for the first time is that they think it's basketball on grass.
Just because
There's just so much movement, and you just described it so well. And there's just so much movement and so much action. The ball is three down, so there is an emphasis on throwing the ball downfield. All the rules are favored towards the offense, so it resembles a little bit of basketball on grass with the movement out there.
And I will say, if your team is down by 16 points at the three-minute warning, fear not. The game is still tight. It's basically tied because there's a good chance they're going to come back and make it a very close game. The Alouettes started their season with that difficult task of playing the road swing through the province of Alberta against the Edmonton Elks, the Calgary Stampeders. How'd that go?
Well, the first game was favorable. We played really well. We won 30-13. I thought we were pretty dominant in all three phases of the game: offense, defense, and special teams. So we were quite happy. Clearly, we had to travel back because of the protocol. We couldn't stay out in Alberta, knowing full well that there was a 6-day swing between playing Edmonton and Calgary. So we went out to Calgary for the second game, got off to a pretty good start, up 14-3. We had a critical turnover mid-second quarter, wasn't able to recuperate from that turnover, yet made it quite interesting. We lost the game 28-22, and we caught the ball at the one-yard line, if we were a yard short from going in on the last play of the game. So coming back with a perfect 2-0 Western Canadian swing record. But it was a little bit of a hiccup, a little bit of a bump in the road, but we're happy to be back home, and we're looking forward to our home opener here before our fans next Friday night.
That'll be exciting Friday. One of the really, I should say there's a couple on that offense. Your quarterback, tell us about Vernon Adams Jr. and running back Stanbeck, who's just outstanding as well.
Yeah, I mean, Vernon, he can beat you so many different ways. He can beat you by throwing the ball downfield, and then he's pretty electrifying once he gets flushed out of the pocket. So once he gets outside that pocket, that's where he can really be at his best, because he can throw the ball on the run, or he can make things happen with his feet. and go get you positive yards. So he just brings so much to the table. He's he's all of 28 years old. He's one of our leaders on our football team. After two games, I think he's got four touchdowns and one interception. So we're looking forward to seeing him do his thing, and we're expecting big things from him here in 2021. As far as standback is concerned, I mean, he's all of 235, 240, and he's tackle to tackle. He can run by people, and he'll get you a lot of those tough yards. He's a bigger back, so clearly the physical aspect of the game is something that that he enjoys, and he always gets stronger with every carry. So as the game goes on, with every carry, he gets a little bit stronger, and he probably has some of his best games in the second half of football games. So it's a pretty good combination that we've got there, and obviously we've got a pretty good or a solid group of receivers, and Vernon's done a pretty good job of distributing the ball for us this year.
I'm speaking with Danny Machocha. He is the general manager of the Montreal Alouettes of the Canadian Football League, getting ready for their first home game of the season. Danny, no CFL season last year, but 2019 was an unexpectedly exciting one for the Al. Started a little strangely. The coach was let go during the short exhibition season. But give us a recap of that year and how that was a real turnaround for the Alouettes.
I think you were bang on with your assessment right there. I mean, I wasn't here just yet because I got the job here in January of 2020. But being close to the organization, I was able to take a look at how things materialized coming out of training camp. So at the conclusion of training camp, the organization had made a decision to go in a different direction with the head coaching position, and they turned over or they gave the keys to Kahari Jones. And there was a lot of questions. It was a little bit of a team that was in turmoil a bit. And to Coach Jones's credit, he was able to rally the troops and finish 10-8, second overall in the East, and had their first home game in a few years. So and he was also
game.
A finalist for Coach of the Year. So we were quite excited with the season that he had coming off a 10-8 season. And that's why we think we have the foundation, a solid foundation in place to pick up where he left off and maybe, hopefully win the division this year.
Now, as general manager, what were you looking for in the players you brought in for this 2021 season?
The key for us was to get much better up front as far as our defensive front was concerned, because we were last in the league in quarterback sacks with 27 in 2019. So, we hit the free agent market. We identified some other players that had played 3-4 years maybe in the NFL and that were available, that were on the streets. We were able to get them to sign a contract and come up to Montreal. And to date, after 2 weeks, we've been quite productive as far as our front seven is concerned. We've been much more active getting to the quarterback, getting the quarterback flushed out of his pocket, get him off his midline, stop the run. So that was a priority for us, and I think we've addressed it.
Now, one other difference with the CFL, you have a number of Canadian players, a number that you have to have on the roster. So how do you balance that with the players that you bring in from the United States?
Well, it's a 44-man roster as we speak right now. So we've got 20 Americans. We've got two quarterbacks who traditionally are clearly Americans. We've got 21 Canadians, and we've got a global player, an international player, who's Joseph Zima right now. He handles our kicking game. So when we sit down every single week, we got to put a roster in place that's composed of this ratio that you have to respect. So you have to have 7 Canadian starters, but you need to have 21 on your roster. So we have to pluck our Canadian starters in there, surround them with Canadian depth at those positions, and make sure that we've got our Americans penciled in, and make sure that we've got depth at those positions too. So it's gymnastics at its best as far as an exercise is concerned, but you have to respect the ratio of 21, 20, and 2 quarterbacks and the global player.
Yeah, and just one more interesting difference between the two leagues. Danny, for fans attending an Owls game, what will they enjoy about coming up to Molson Stadium?
Well, it's in downtown Montreal, so when we do have an evening game, a night game like we do have coming up here Friday night, you get to see the backdrop, the skyline of the city of Montreal. Mm-hmm. Like I said, you're in downtown Montreal. There's a lot of fine dining in downtown Montreal. Like I said, it's also on the campus of McGill University. It's a beautiful campus. We've got the mountain that separates the University of Montreal and the University of McGill. So the scenery is quite spectacular.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, some of those McGill buildings look like something out of Harry Potter. They're incredible. You mentioned the University of Montreal. Danny, would you be surprised if I told you that I saw you win the Vanier Cup at Molson Stadium with the caravan of the University of Montreal?
I would be surprised, actually. I'm quite surprised.
It was a fabulous day. First of all, tell people what the Vanier Cup is.
The Vanier Cup is the equivalent of the national championship game that's played every year. There's 27 schools in Canada that have the opportunity to play and compete for the Vanier Cup. We've got four different conferences here in Canada. There's Canada West, there's the OUA, which is primarily a conference composed of schools in Ontario. They've got, I think they've got 11 universities in that conference. There's the RSAQ, which is the five institutions that play in the province of Quebec. And then there's the AUS, which is the Maritimes, and they've got four schools. And they all have an opportunity every year, once you win your conference, to face off against one another and ultimately play in the Vanier Cup championship game.
Yeah, and it was an exciting win for the caravan of the University of Montreal, coming over the mountain and winning there on the campus of McGill. Now, give us a little bit of your background in Canadian football, Danny.
So, I started as a volunteer coach. I mean, I was doing a lot of coaching at the civil football, midget football, junior football, and had the opportunity to meet some great coaches along the way, and volunteered my time in 1996 as a quality control coach with the Montreal Alouettes. So I did some volunteer work here for 2 years. It was full-time volunteer work. And then I had a 14-year career that extended itself with 6 years in Montreal and 8 years in Edmonton. And I occupied several positions, from a running back coach to offensive coordinator to head coach in Edmonton and general manager in Edmonton. Been blessed playing in four Grey Cup games, winning two in 2003 and 2005 versus the Montreal Alouettes when I was in Edmonton.
We won't hold that against you, Danny.
We won't hold it against you. Came back from Edmonton, spent 9 years at the University of Montreal, won the Vanier Cup in 2014, and as of January 2020, I took over the job here as general manager with the Montreal Alouettes.
How much does it mean to you to be back with the Alouettes?
It's been awesome. I'm quite fortunate to say I got an opportunity to realize my dream twice. Once in 96 when I did it as a quality control coach. It was so important for me to be associated with my local team here, and then to come back in 2020 in a different capacity as far as the job description is concerned, and build and lead this team is definitely a privilege.
Now, I want to tell fans, when you go to Molson Stadium, the announcements are made both in French and English, so it does make it easy to follow. But I have found that the one thing you should understand the French for is when they want you to make some noise. So, Danny, what is it they tell you to do at Percival Molson Stadium? Say it in French so everyone knows that that's the time to get really amped up.
Well, the direct translation is c'est de brie.
C'est de brie. C'est de brie.
That's right. You got it. You've got it down pat now.
You can tell I've been to Molson Stadium a number of times. Luckily, I had four opportunities in that 2019 season, including that playoff game, which was really exciting. So I'm looking forward to a good 2020 season, a 2021 season now for the Owls. So what's it like in Montreal right now? Can you feel the excitement building for this first home game?
Absolutely. There are some restrictions with capacity as far as how many fans you can have enter the building next Friday. I think we're at 15,000 capacity, but we know for a fact that all 15,000 will be sold here. There's a lot of excitement around this football team. We think we're going to be quite entertaining, as you may have witnessed over the last couple of weeks. And I think the guys are really excited to take the field and play before our home fans here, and this has been 2 years in waiting here. So there's a ton of excitement, and we can't wait for Friday to roll around.
All right, Danny, I'm going to give you one last question. I want you, for American fans, as best you can, explain the rouge.
The rouge basically is when you line up, kick a field goal, and it's wide. And you either have the option to run it out, or you can concede the point and you take a knee in the end zone. So that's the equivalent of a rouge, or on a punt that lands in the end zone and you decide not to run it out and you concede a point. That's the equivalent of what a rouge would mean.
It's a single point, and remember, 20-yard deep end zone, so you might be way back in the end zone when you receive it. So there's no fair catch in Canadian football, 1 foot in bounds. So like I said, it moves fast. It's a lot of action. It's a lot of fun. Danny Machocha is the general manager of the Montreal Alouettes of the Canadian Football League. You can learn more at montrealalouettes.com. Danny, thanks so much for joining us this morning, and best of luck the rest of the season.
Thank you, and have a great day.
All right, you too. Great talking to you. That is our show for today. Vermont Viewpoint is directed by Danny McGivergan and produced by Rachel Connor and Brady Jalili. Our email address, vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Feel free to suggest topics or guests. You can listen to past episodes of Vermont Viewpoint by downloading our podcast at wdevradio.com. The Vermont Viewpoint podcast is sponsored by the Warren Store, funky, friendly, and almost world famous. Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayers up next. I'm Rick Sengary. I'll meet you back here tomorrow when we're going to learn more about the Northeast Kingdom from author Scott Wheeler. And we've got an hour of the Summer Wine Show here on WDEV.